Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Tom Pearson to the show. He's a spokesperson in York Region for Put Food in the Budget campaign and the chairman of the Poverty Action for Change Coalition, or PAC. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I read your article in the Star, Food Supplement Needed Immediately. It sounds a little more urgent than most people's take on the problem of poverty and food. I gather that you think that government is impoverishing people on fixed incomes, from what you said.
Well, that's part of it, and it seemed to have lost us. There doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency either.
Right.
You know, I've been at this for a number of years now, and I'm just finding that people are more desperate than ever at this time than they've been. So, you know, for a government in a time when they've announced they're going to be creating poverty reduction strategy, I just, you know, I'm at a loss to see it.
Yeah.
It's very discouraging.
Well, you mentioned that the Star had pointed out the current adult rate for workfare is $585 a month, not enough to buy food and pay the rent, let alone other basic necessities. Now, you've indicated this is worse for people with special medical conditions who may or may not be on disability benefits.
I mean, if you think about trying to live on $585 a month to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd be lucky to get a room for $350, $400 a month.
Right.
If you're lucky. So, you know, it's already leaving you less than a healthy food basket of food would cost you a month.
Yeah.
So let alone, when that's without a phone or without clothing or without medicine or without transportation to get medicine or
right.
transportation for anything. So it's the people are already at a complete disadvantage. So what's been happening is they've had a thing called a special diet that people could apply for over and above that $585.
Right.
So that's kind of been a small safety net for people, if you will, to be able to apply for that. And it could be anywhere from $22 up to a maximum of $250. They could have a number of conditions that would result in them having to have that much extra to be able to eat.
Yeah.
And people might have, for example, people will have allergies, just regular, normal, everyday foods that people take for granted that they can eat. You're not going to be able to access that on $585 a month.
Yeah.
When you know, 70% of it has gone to your rent.
Yeah. Well, for instance, corn allergy is very common, but so are corn sweeteners. How are you going to stay away from them on $585 a month?
And this is it.
Yeah.
What they've said is that special diet is not sustainable, and so they haven't announced officially that they're eliminating it, but they're announcing that they're redesigning it and recalling it, or they're launching it under another name, so they're eliminating the program completely, and they're going to relaunch something else called they're calling it the nutritional supplement.
All right.
And so what they're doing in a sense, though, is they've already said that they can't, it is not sustainable.
Right.
So that tells you that they're going to cut. So it's a cut. So really what they're doing is they're going to eliminate many of those people that are getting the special diet. So, you know, a number of those people who may qualify for disability support but just have not applied for that or have not been accepted through the whatever hoops they've had to jump through to get it. But now they'll be cut off from getting their special diet. So they'll even be, in, you know, worse shape than ever.
Well, they may have misled me. It wouldn't be the first time they've done so, but they tell me that the special diet won't be cut off for people who are on it, but the people that it's cut off for are the new applicants, the people who need it just as badly.
Well, you really have to look at their words carefully.
Yeah.
When they've said something is not sustainable.
Right. Well, reason we talked about this, it's not the special diet program that's not sustainable. The whole system's not sustainable because of the low levels of income that they provide.
Even, minimum wage. Try surviving. Recently, there was a call for people working on minimum wage, a CBC documentary. You know, they couldn't find anybody that was just living on minimum wage. Because it's impossible.
Oh, I see. Living,
virtually impossible to live on it unless you're... You know, you're bunked up with a whack of people. I mean, you try living on $400 a week minus taxes in this day and age.
It's just,
so to get $10 an hour as being supposedly this big accomplishment that's happened, $10 an hour minimum wage, try living on it.
I have a friend who works for a large foreign-based department store and makes $12 an hour, and it's just, it's just not enough.
No, and that's the thing. When my father came over to this country as an immigrant years ago, a newcomer, they would call him now, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, he came here. He had five kids. You know, not when he got here. He had one kid, one child when he got here. But he was sweeping floors, and he was able to save up enough money from that job sweeping floors to buy a house, to get a down payment, and actually get a house with five kids and one person working. Whatever happened to that?
Yeah.
You know, the situation now is such that. Since the 90s, when Harris made those cuts in the 90s, we're actually in a worse position. Those people on welfare, low-income workers, and ODSP, people on disabilities and pensions, they are actually in a worse position today than they were when Harris made those cuts. Because when he made those cuts, he made 21.8% cut way back in 1995.
Welfare cuts, yeah.
And yes, and since that time... You've essentially had a cost of living raise most years, and then actually this year, when this new government has made their poverty reduction strategy their big thing, they gave 1%, which isn't even the cost of living this year.
I don't think there were any cost of living increases during the Harris years.
Well, since because McGuinty came in and no cost of living increase, and as you just mentioned, you're still actually further behind now than we were with the Harris government. This is what. People don't seem to realize people are in worse positions now than they ever were.
Yeah.
And there's no comparison to when people were kids and their experience as kids living in poverty. It is not the same anymore. People are having to access just the basic necessities such as food at a food depot or a food bank. Back then, they didn't even exist. Food banks came out in the 70s. It was supposed to be around for a couple of weeks. Now it's become a reliance. Whatever happened to being able to put food on your own table without having to, the dignity, losing your one's dignity of having to go and essentially beg people for food, for clothing, for a roof on, to keep a roof over their head. This is just disgusting what's happened to this country.
I understand there's 5% food inflation so far this year, and the year's not done. So this 1% increase comes nowhere near to meeting the inflation needs.
A loaf of bread has gone up a dollar in the last year. Do people realize that? I'll bet you the people most aware of that are those that got the 1% increase from $582 to $585 or whatever it is a month.
Yeah.
Now they can buy, an extra loaf of bread?
Yeah, yeah.
That's essentially what they gave them. They gave an extra loaf of bread a month.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, the cost of that loaf of bread has gone up. they've not kept up.
I think I mentioned to you the figures that I have are from 2009. They talk about the increase in the number of people who are accessing EI in 2009. Well, do the math. Those are the people who are dropping off the other end of EI in 2010. And if the increase in 2009 was 100%, then the increase in people who've fallen off it in 2010 is 100%.
Sure. We've had food bank use has been most food banks will tell you that there's been an increase in food bank usage of about 50% in just since 2001 or so.
Yeah, and it's
that's
still
a lot of people.
It's still increasing. I volunteer at the Sally Ann, and they're doling out 800-900 sandwiches a night now in Hamilton to homeless people.
The meal programs.
who are on the street. Yeah, that's 800-900 people every night who can't feed themselves.
Exactly, and we see the same thing. We have the churches that are putting on the they call it a community dinner. You know.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting idea, but you know what? People would rather be able to put that dinner on their own table and have a family dinner. They don't want a community dinner. They want to have a family dinner with their own family, and they want to pick the food they would like to eat, that their kids like, you know, and they don't want to have to go and access a place to access food, you know? It's just wrong.
Well, we have figures here based on the change from October 2008 to January 2009. Now, I realize these figures are over a year old, but things haven't gotten better in the meantime, and the number of EI beneficiaries climbed 103% in that time, which is about 4 months in Windsor, 96% in Kitchener, 83% here in Hamilton and in London.
Wow.
So those are the people, they have already dropped off the EI rolls. Those are the people who are thronging the soup vans and the soup kitchens in our cities. And more of them fall off the EI rolls every day.
And they expect, what it comes down to for many people is impossible choices, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like only 17% of Canadian families have access to regulated child care, for example.
Yeah.
So what are the other 83% supposed to do that can't afford it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they have to rely on something. Something has to be in place to help them. During that time, because you can't just not have someone looking after your kids.
Yeah.
But they expect everyone to be out there working. But yet there's nothing in place for that. And then so when they have to fall into a situation where they need assistance, they have to beg for food, you know?
Yeah. And you mentioned you've done a social audit that showed that these people are being humiliated every time they want their needs met.
Yeah.
What was that audit? Who was it for?
Well, there's the ISARC social audit. It was done right across Ontario in different communities. Each sort of area can.
What does ISARC stand for?
ISARC is it's an interfaith social audit. So it's all the faiths.
Yep.
And what they do, they've been doing social audits across Ontario for a number of years. I believe since 1987. And so every 4 or 5 years, they do a social audit. An organization will host, and you'll organize it in such a way that you have people living in poverty from experience coming in and telling a panel, and it's rapporteurs, we call them, and you try to find people within those communities that are highly and widely respected,
okay.
And they listen to what's going on in those people's lives,
right.
And then everything is recorded. You kind of break it all down, and you take out quotes, and you relate those quotes to social scenarios, and it's like a social audit, so you're able to break it down and get into the nitty-gritty of the areas of what are specific areas where people are being affected. And one of the biggest things that jumped out was the way people are being treated. Just to access a program, to access, even those are on ODSP that go in for glasses, for eyewear, for example. There are certain eyeglass places that treat people on the government ODSP system like I'll just say garbage. You know, they just don't treat them well.
Yeah.
And then they'll go into another place and get that kind of same treatment at a dentist's office. I've had a woman sitting there getting a root canal done.
Right.
Well, the dentist stopped halfway through to phone to find out if ODSP would cover it. When he was not able to get an adequate answer, he simply sewed up the woman and sent her on her way.
Really?
Well, she ended up in the hospital in critical care.
Really?
And nothing's ever done for it because, you know, she can't afford a lawyer. She can't afford lawsuits. She has no idea about how to go about anything like that.
Yeah,
and this woman's lived a nightmare.
The workers are very smug about this. One worker told me when I went in to get eyeglasses, I said, well, I volunteered for 10 years, and I've always gotten a pair of glasses for my volunteer work as well as for wearing on the street. I said, because my needs are different when I volunteer. I work at a computer. I need glasses for working with the computer, middle focus glasses. With the middle focus on the top, where the distance usually is, and reading on the bottom for my research material on the desk in front of the computer and the microphone. And she said, oh, we don't provide second pairs anymore. I said, do you want the feds in here, tearing apart your paperwork and asking if this is discrimination? She says, I've told you what you can have. I said, yeah, well, I've told you what you're going to get. And I am.
I'm going after them.
That's another area that Canadians were terrible at. Did you know that over 40% of Canadians with disabilities are not in the labor force here? We rank like 27th of 29, countries. We're 27th in.
I think it's dawned on the feds. I don't know if it's dawned on the province yet. With baby boomers growing older and all of them facing disabilities, and to imply that this means you exit the workforce implies a tremendous loss of income for the government. And I think the feds have caught on to that.
Definitely. They write people off.
But that
another example, let me give you another quick example. One of our longtime members is in a wheelchair, and when he was walking, he was a hardworking guy, and he really misses that, but he can't do that now. But one thing he can do is he can DJ, And he was really excited about the prospect of DJing, and I was able to get him some work in that area. But we couldn't get him home.
Yeah,
he's got an electronic wheelchair, and in York Region, apparently, if you're in that situation, you can't get home past 10:30 at night. They don't have anything. So, if the guy wanted to go to a wedding, or if he wanted to work, or if he wanted to just go out and enjoy himself, and not have a curfew like a little child, he can't even do that. And, this is something that people don't realize. It's isolating people. And he said to me just the other day, he said, Tom, now I know what you mean about the mental health. I go, what do you mean? He goes, I know what you mean by that now. He's just had it. He doesn't have the energy to make 6 phone calls to get a ride somewhere and to go to the hospital and access this and go over here and do that and this. He's one person, but this is happening over and over again to people. We have to set the things up so that people aren't living in constant crisis here.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think people know what it feels like to be dependent by law. You have to have your assets reduced to $500 worth of liquid assets before you even qualify for workfare, which is where even people with disabilities start. They start on workfare. So before they get disability benefits, if they get them, they get workfare. And maybe they don't ever get off workfare. But to get workfare, they have to have liquid assets of less than $500. What does this do to their satisfaction with their day-to-day existence and their stress levels as related to their medical situation?
What they're expecting is what's happening. They're going around and having to beg and borrow and everything else, right?
Yeah.
So that can't be right. So, they're looking at actually rent subsidies and these types of things now that won't have to necessarily be in social housing. So they are looking at those types of things to help out in that area, which theoretically should reduce the rent, which theoretically should give you more disposable income. However, I know people that from living from a social housing aspect, one third of whatever you're making, that's still what they're going to be taking for your rent. You likely wouldn't qualify for housing anyways if you're single, because there's no social housing for singles in Ontario. There's very, very little.
Oh, okay.
You have to be either have kids or be a senior. Other than that, you're looking at most places at 12 to 20 year waiting lists.
Yeah. Well, I was on the waiting list in Toronto for 17 years, and I finally told them to stuff it.
Yeah. 17 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
A problem, too, with subsidized housing that I've only recently become aware of, and that's if you earn income, they take 50% of the income that you've earned, but it goes against your rent subsidy. Because you've earned the income, your rent goes up by a third of the money that you've earned, never mind they take 50% of it. And then you pay tax on that money, too, which you don't on your fixed income.
Right. Yeah, so that's what I mean. Even if you make more, they take it anyway.
Yeah.
There has to be a system set up wherein it makes it so that people can get a little bit ahead. What's wrong with someone being able to save $50 a month? I mean, people aren't even able to do that. It's just a minefield and impossible choices. That's what I call it. People are asked to make impossible choices. Do I pay my rent and keep my roof? Do I lose my phone? Does my kid not participate in school because I can't afford to send him on the bus because they don't have any busing, because we're 1.8 kilometers away instead of 2.0? But my kid is not willing to walk the hour to get there in the winter?
Yeah.
They have to make it so that there's not impossible choices for people. It's not asking too much, I don't think, for people to be able to put on their own table their food, to pay their rent, and to have clothing on their backs, and maybe to even be able to go out every once a month and go to McDonald's or something like that.
Certainly,
people aren't even able to do that anymore.
For the kids, they've got to take part in the other programs that the kids at school take part in. But if those programs are underfunded and the school has the charge, that automatically means if your mom or dad is poor, I'm sorry, you're left out, you know.
Those kids are already left out.
Yeah.
Those kids are already left out, where the school's particularly asking for uniforms for the school team, and there are kids that are just too embarrassed to let them know, look, I don't have the money, you know, so they just simply don't go, and that's not a stat that shows up anywhere, believe me.
Yeah, that's true.
But, and the same with the transportation. These kids that just stop going, you know, that doesn't show up anywhere as any particular reason, but, you know, it's, again, because they didn't have the first of all, they didn't have a bus. Secondly, they didn't have the funds to access the local transit each day to get that kid to school. These are little things that don't show up on all of the stats, but they're adding up. And you know, I don't know if you heard about the sick report, but you know, the longer we keep people in poverty, the more billions of dollars it costs us. So
yeah,
we'd be much smarter to be setting up systems that are what I call step out programs. You know, it help you know, for those that need to be permanently on the system, we set it up in such a way that yes, they can be on the system and still not have to beg and borrow each month. And for those that are looking for to give back, we can set it up so that they're able to do that and give back and maybe make some income from that, particularly ODSP people. And we can set it up where we have systems that help people step out of the situation they're in, that they want to change and move forward. And we can set it up so that they're able to do that, you know. Right now it just seems to be programs come out of nowhere with no thought. They don't come from the ground up, which they should. You know, I attended a Pan-Canadian Poverty Conference a couple of years back, and one of the big things that I got out of that from places like Quebec and Nova Scotia and that do much better with poverty than Ontario ever would even dream of. But they're one of the things that came out of that was most of the successful community programs came from the communities themselves from the ground on up. So they were essentially the people came up with them. They came up with the ideas and the programs and what the needs were for the community. And it came that way as opposed to the top down where, you know, you get a regional government or a city government or a provincial or federal saying, okay, well, we're going to give you this, you know, but really there's been no input from the ground up. So, and I'll give you an example of that is a very, very low income community in Montreal. I think it was Saint-Denis, I'm not 100% sure, but they had Cirque du Soleil there, one of the buildings that were in that community, and they approached Cirque du Soleil about a program for, you know, people in that low-income community that would could train them to, you know, be part of it. And it came from a discussion like that to being a big program that now kids and people from that low-income community have become Cirque du Soleil people. And,
oh, yeah.
And just, you know, something simple like that. But it came from the community on up. They saw a need. They saw something that was part of their community. They approached them, and lo and behold, now it's a long-running program that's reaped unbelievable benefits for those people.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've become less caring or if we've just we're just not paying attention to others around us anymore or what it is. But I was actually very surprised that our politicians have not done more than they've done, knowing what they know. Because they all, for example, we did the math with all of the, we've gone right across Ontario and had the MPPs do the math.
Right.
We asked them to do the math, figure out how much would it cost someone on the lowest of incomes to survive. And virtually all of them come up with a number that's somewhere anywhere between $1,200 and $1,500 and $1,600, we'll say.
Yeah.
Yet they expect people to survive on $585.
Yeah.
But they do the math themselves. They figure out rent. They figure out the phone. They figure out. So then we ask them to go back and say, well, what would you have to do then? You'd have to eliminate what? So you'd eliminate a phone. You'd have to eliminate TV. You'd have to eliminate.
News for you. That's already eliminated for most of us.
Yeah.
You were talking about health costs for people who were denied the things they need to remain healthy on these benefits, Tom.
By just allowing people to wallow in poverty, if you will, without doing anything about it, we're actually ending up costing us billions and billions of dollars in health care costs.
And to your mind, this sells to the conservative constituency? Cleese, for instance, bought this?
Well, this is what I was saying. Cleese had said to me, you know, how can I sell this to a boardroom? How can I sell this to people?
All right.
You know, just giving a raise.
And did he buy what you said?
How can I sell that? And that's when we come up with the idea, well, we'd have to sell it in a business form. They understand facts and figures, right? So let's do it in a let's sell it in a sense that, look, how can you afford not to do anything about it? It's going to cost you billions and billions in health care costs if you don't. And here they are.
Yeah.
And we've begun to sort of list them.
Diabetes is epidemic, for one thing.
Diabetes, yeah, it's a good example. And much more prevalent with low-income people.
Yeah.
Much more prevalent.
Starch and sugar, yeah.
Sure. I mean, what can you afford? Can you, you know, what can you afford to eat? You're gonna, can you afford the bag of Cheesies, or can you afford the healthy snack?
Mac and cheese, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and wiener, high cholesterol wieners.
But one of the biggest things that that everybody could do better, and I mean everybody, that one of the biggest things that everybody can do better is treating people with a little more dignity and respect. You know, believe me, people don't want to be in the positions that they're in. Most people would rather be doing something constructive to help other people and living in dignity. You know, people don't want to, for the most part, be cheating a system and just siphoning off of it. In my experience, those are the exceptions, not the rule.
Yeah.
But our system is set up as the rule,
yeah.
You know? And one of the biggest things that came out of our social audit that affects people is the way people are treated at every turn. And I think everybody can do a better job there, from the doctors to the social workers to the even the program workers. I mean, you know, imagine put yourself in someone's position that has to rely on all these things, that has no choice, and may have been very proud and too proud to ask for help in the past, but now has had been forced to.
Yeah.
You know, put yourself in that position. I mean, it's the problem, I think, is people have this predisposed notion of what people on low income are. And they can say that a lot of them just, there's an old stereotype of them, they're all just lazy and they deserve it, you know?
Yeah.
And quite frankly, it couldn't be more the opposite in most cases. These are people that care. These are people that want to be contributing. These are people that are that have children. They have families. They want to contribute, and they're just looking for a way to. And that's what we should be doing, is we should be providing ways that they can.
Instead of denying them the inclusion in our society.
Sure.
Yeah.
They want to be included. They want to be doing something. They you know, virtually throughout the social audits, we heard that from almost everybody. And most of the people were either homeless or on ODSP or on welfare and low-income workers. But literally, I mean, that really resonated with me. It was something that was sincere coming out of everybody. No one wanted to sponge off any system, and no one wanted to be in the positions they were in. But circumstance happened with people in life, circumstance of health, circumstance of situation. The longer you're in, you chip and chip and chip away at people's self-esteem, and mental health becomes an issue, and it just goes downhill from there. So, you know, we need to assist people, let them know that they're welcome and they're contributing members of society, and that we still love them. You know, Stop treating people with such disrespect. It's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've hit on the name of the show, which is disrespect. We spell it with a capital R to emphasize the respect that needs to be shown to people who become disadvantaged and want to get back to the way that they were when they were self-sufficient. I appreciate your time to comment on this on the show. Your letter was impassioned and the interview's been impassioned. Was there anything that we forgot that you would like to add before we go?
Well, I'd invite everybody to do the math. You can go to www.povertywatchontario.ca.
Right.
Or www.dothemath.thestop.org.
Right.
And also upcoming is October 17th, which is International Day for the Eradication of Poverty.
Okay.
So organize an event in your area, and that's the day that was given around the world. It's an internationally acclaimed day where it's a day to give a voice to those in poverty. So what we do is we set up a stage and a microphone. We allow anybody who would like to come up and speak out against poverty can. And then now we now have musicians that come out and perform songs they've written specific to the issue, and now we have rappers coming, and it's a growing sort of event. But you can start one of those everywhere, and it's just that one day of the year where the concentration is on that. The International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. It's a voice to those in poverty, because quite frankly, I don't hear enough of them out there, and there needs to be more.
Appreciate that. Okay, thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
All right. Goodbye. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the full stories that we read to you. These are excerpts or condensations of the stories from the papers that we announce in the broadcast. National Post, Friday, August 27th. Toronto became the first city in the world to endorse the Vienna Declaration, August 26th, raising its voice against the war on drugs. The war against drugs has failed, said Councillor Kyle Ray, who brought the declaration to City Council. The principles of the declaration favor a public health approach to dealing with drug addicts rather than enforcing drug laws that critics argue do not work. Just as clearly as we know HIV is the cause of AIDS, we know the war on drugs doesn't achieve its stated objectives and contributes to a range of harms, including the spread of HIV, said Dr. Evan Wood, a research physician at the University of British Columbia and who chaired the writing committee. A public health approach to addiction typically includes methadone clinics, safe injection or consumption sites, and the decriminalization of drugs. A feasibility report on safe consumption sites in Toronto is expected next year. That by Zoe McKnight in the National Post. Toronto Star, Tuesday, August 24th. Kate Allen, G20 legal tidal wave hits court. 300 defendants charged with G20-related offenses jammed a Toronto courthouse a week ago Monday in a day-long legal tidal wave that critics say highlights deep flaws in the summit's policing strategy. More than 1,000 people were detained in Toronto during the June 25th to 27th meeting of world leaders, the largest mass arrests in Canadian history. What's amazing and extraordinary and questionable is that the scope of the mass arrests created a problem for the judicial system, said Natalie Desrosiers, general counsel for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. We suspect that many of the charges will be settled or abandoned, but it does raise significant issues about how this can be done while respecting constitutional rights. Two buses arrived from Montreal with approximately 50 defendants in each. Fire code regulations permitted only 176 people in the hallways of the Ontario Court of Justice at one time, so extra police were brought on. Some cases were dropped Monday, including the charges against Natalie Gray, who was arrested outside the Eastern Avenue Detention Center after being hit in the sternum and the elbow with two sublethal bullets, leaving lasting damage. She said she plans to sue. Others had their charges diverted after agreeing to donate money to a registered charity. Several people accused of being anarchist ringleaders, including Kelly Rose Flugback, had their cases adjourned until September. Vincent Marzano, a 21-year-old philosophy student from the Université du Québec à Montréal, was a passenger on one of the buses from Montreal. On Monday, he received a synopsis of the Crown's case against him and a summons to return to the Ontario Court of Justice on Finch Avenue on October 13th. Appearing before the judge, Mr. Marzano asked why there was such a long gap between court dates and was told the Crown needed time to review hours of video evidence. Mr. Marzano objected outside the courtroom, saying the delays made it difficult to schedule the coming months. Ms. Desrosiers agreed, calling cases like Mr. Marzano's inappropriate. In our view, the mistake is to have decided to charge people without having the chance to review whether there was enough evidence. They should have checked before they laid charges, she said. Toronto Star, Betsy Powell Courts Bureau. Judge slams police response. Matthew Camus, a Hamilton welder, was charged March 16, 2008, with assaulting constables Mark Tracy, Maria Nunez, and Darren Yeo outside a Richmond Street West nightclub. During a trial that ended in May, the Crown called seven witnesses, all police officers. Camus, his sister and girlfriend, testified for the defense. The judge also reviewed a DVD of injuries Camus, 26, suffered, including bruising and red marks. The Crown alleged Camus, while seeking a taxi and without provocation, punched Tracy, who was in plain clothes, breaking his glasses, and then assaulted the two other uniformed officers. However, Justice Paul Reinhart wasn't convinced the officers who testified actually saw what transpired at the outset of the encounter between Tracy and Camus. I find as a fact and prefer Mr. Camus' version of what happened, namely that he was shoved by Constable Tracy, shoved back, and then was punched by Mr. Tracy before he punched back at Tracy, Reinhard wrote in a decision released August 10th. The overall testimony of the three defense witnesses was credible, and their shock and disbelief at the level of police violence an understandable response, the judge wrote. The officers used excessive force while arresting Camus, then again after he was subdued, and again in crowd control when his female companions were knocked down, Reinhard wrote. The Toronto judge acquitted Camus of assaulting the three officers in Toronto's entertainment district after finding the man was the victim of excessive use of force of police. We'll read the judgment carefully, taking into account the judge's comments, Toronto police spokesman Mark Pugash said Tuesday. And from the National Post, Friday, August 27th, Chris Selly, more power to them. Breathless news coverage welcomed the impending arrival of a study from the RCMP, which reportedly finds that Canada's long gun registry as a whole is an important tool for law enforcement. Increases accountability of firearm owners for their firearms. And is cost-effective in reducing firearms-related crime and promoting public safety. The police know how to keep us safe, surely. Why would they ever fib about the gun registry? Gun registry opponents, many of them as pro-cop as they come, fumed and fulminated. Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair was also in the news as the guy who headed up the largest mass arrest in Canadian history during the G20 summit in June. If police officers generally arrest people in expectation they've got the right man for the right crime, then you'd like to think they're a bit chagrined at this point. Of the 1,100 people arrested that weekend, 800 were never charged. Reports say around 100 of the remaining 300 had their charges dropped on Monday. This included someone who was blowing bubbles at a police officer. Someone who wrote "Shame on you" in charcoal on a sidewalk. A uniformed TTC employee on his way to work. And two accredited National Post photographers, the wrong people, arrested for no crime at all. As John Geddes reported in Maclean's, in the fall of 2009, the RCMP was ready to win. Publicly that it had commissioned, shall we say, less than rigorous research with a specific intention of undermining peer-reviewed studies attesting to the positive effects of InStite, the safe injection center on Vancouver's tumble-down East Hastings Street. The RCMP recognizes that these reviews did not meet conventional standards. The RCMP was to concede at a joint press conference with the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS. Needless to say, there was no such press conference. Headquarters in Ottawa wouldn't hear of it. It's possible this forthcoming RCMP report on the long gun registry contains new information that vindicates the program. Perhaps it will abandon the maddening law enforcement habit of telling Canadians how many times officers consulted the registry and explain the concrete positive results of those consultations. I doubt it, though, and so should everyone else until they have the report in their hands. If the Mounties will commission junk science to bolster their bias against harm reduction programs, why wouldn't they commission junk science to bolster their bias in favor of the long gun registry? The registry certainly doesn't make police officers' lives any more difficult or less safe. It's conceivable that it could someday help them solve a crime. So why wouldn't they support it? But the G20 offers another more basic explanation. The police enjoy wielding power. They're in favor of having more power, and they're opposed to having less. 1,100 arrests, 900 of them bogus and counting. If the police or anyone else had a knockout, non-theoretical argument in favor of the gun registry, I'd have thought they'd have made it by now.
And from the Globe and Mail, Natalie Steckison. Rayal, Jensen, Jardine, Douglas family were waiting with the police they'd called to help get their son into treatment for mental health issues when they heard over a two-way police radio that he'd been shot and killed by an officer. Among his symptoms, Mr. Jardine Douglas, 25, suffered from paranoia, according to a statement written by his family and obtained by the Globe and Mail. He boarded a southbound bus on Victoria Park Avenue and was shot during an altercation with police after the bus was pulled over. His family are devastated with how events played out, their lawyer Glenn Stewart said. They were making efforts to try and help him and support him, and those have seemingly gone terribly, terribly wrong because of the way they were handled by the police service, Mr. Stewart said. A woman visiting friends in the building behind the bus said she heard 6 to 8 shots. She asked not to be named. I thought it was firecrackers at first, she said. Then I heard the sirens and thought, oh my God, something is happening. The victim's family had been trying to get help for the man for several days. According to the statement, Mr. Jardine Douglas saw a physician about his symptoms of mental illness on August the 27th. The next day, his family took him to a hospital but were referred to a second hospital after being told that it did not have the resources at the time to assist the man. He may be another telling example of someone who the system failed, said Mr. Stewart, the family's lawyer. The family had taken Mr. Jardine Douglas to a second hospital on August 29th but said he was uncooperative. The family called the police for help. A move that ended in his death. Toronto Star, Wednesday, September 1st, Brendan Kennedy, staff reporter. The family of the 25-year-old Pickering man, Rayal Jardine Douglas, fatally shot by police on Sunday, says he suffered from mental illness, including paranoia, and that they had called police to get him admitted to hospital. Jardine Douglas was shot by an officer after he fled from a bus when it was pulled over by police at about 3:10 p.m. The revelation has reignited criticism of the police 3 weeks before a coroner's inquest opens into a similar police shooting 2 years ago. On February 16, 2008, 28-year-old Byron DeBassige, who had schizophrenia, was shot dead by police in Oriel Park after he stole lemons from a local grocery store armed with a 10-centimeter knife. Officers were cleared of wrongdoing by the Special Investigations Unit, which said DeBassige advanced towards them and ignored repeated commands to drop the knife. But DeBassige family and Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto say the officers needlessly escalated the situation. The incident paralleled a June 2004 case when police shot O'Brien Christopher Reed, 26, who suffered paranoid delusions after he refused to drop a knife when confronted in Edwards Gardens. An inquest cleared officers of wrongdoing, but recommended police receive further training on dealing with the mentally ill and de-escalation techniques. It's an ongoing problem, said lawyer Marshall Swadron, chair of Toronto's Mental Health Legal Committee. There's always an inquest pending or a shooting happening. In 1997, Toronto police fatally shot Edmund Yu, a 35-year-old man with schizophrenia who was wielding a hammer on a Spadina Avenue bus. A subsequent coroner's inquest probed the police department's approach to dealing with mental illness and led to improved officer training, the creation of a mobile task force, and the reinstatement of its crisis resolution course. That inquest came less than 5 years after an inquest made similar recommendations to improve training following the 1988 police shooting death of Lester Donaldson, who also suffered from schizophrenia. I'm worried that the investment in training is not changing police attitudes, Swadron said. The question is how to de-escalate these kinds of situations instead of causing these kinds of disastrous consequences, which seem almost regular. Spurred by the rash of police shooting deaths of people with mental illness in the 80s and 90s, Toronto officers now undergo mandatory training at the Ontario Police College to learn how to deal with such calls. But Swadron remains unconvinced it has helped. Quote, we obviously have some more lessons to learn, unquote. Andrew Picard, The Globe and Mail. Mental health system needs urgent treatment. A committee of the Ontario Legislature released a hard-hitting report on the need to fundamentally transform the province's mental health and addiction system. Then, 3 days later, As if to underscore the urgency of implementing its recommendations, Toronto Police shot to death Rael Jensen Jardine Douglas, 25. His crime seems to have been to suffer from mental illness. Invariably, police and families are put in this untenable situation because the sick individual was untreated. The shooter, the ill person, and the grieving family are all victims of a broken system. The legislature committee pointed out quite astutely that while mental illness and addictions are medical conditions, they have become criminalized to a troubling degree. More than one-third of people in custody in Ontario suffer from a diagnosed mental illness, and substance abuse is a factor in half of all criminal offenses. Far too many Ontarians experience their first contact with the mental health system through the justice system, the MPPs wrote. Police need to be better trained to deal with people suffering from mental illness, and these sick individuals need to be sentenced to care, not jail. It's a travesty that families have trouble getting care for family members who are clearly very ill, yet refuse treatment or are too quickly discharged. This is not freedom. It's a death sentence. Similarly, privacy laws create perverse situations where families are emotionally and financially invested in caring for a loved one, but are denied even the most basic information about their condition. As the MPP said succinctly in the report's conclusion, the necessary changes have yet to be made, and individuals continue to suffer. Toronto Star, Diana Zlomislik, staff reporter. 3 years after Moncton teenager Ashley Smith's death, Toronto Deputy Chief Coroner Dr. Benita Porter has put a gag order on discussions of reasons why the inquest into Smith's death, slated for November, should be expanded to look at the final 12 months in her sad life. It is troubling to the family that a sealing order of this magnitude would have been made, essentially creating a secret proceeding totally cut off from the public, lawyer Julian Falconer told The Star. The coroner's decision to hold a secret proceeding on the family's motion to broaden the scope of the inquest, supported by the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies and the Office of the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth, which have brought forward additional motions for the production of documents that have so far been held back, feels like another blow. With all due respect to Dr. Porter, Falconer said he hasn't seen a sealing order like this from a coroner during his 20 years in practice. Susan Chapman, the lawyer representing Elizabeth Fry, concurs. When a motion is of such great public importance, to essentially be told, just mail it in, we'll let you know. It's surprising. This is a problem we have with dealing with governments in a general sense, said Richard Macklin, lawyer for the Office of Ontario's Children and Youth Advocate, which supports the family's motion for a broader inquest scope. Bureaucracies feel the information they have belongs to them, when in fact the information belongs to the public. Just 19 years old, Smith died inside a segregation cell at Grand Valley Institution for Women in October 2007 after strangling herself with a piece of cloth while guards, who were ordered not to intervene, watched. Prison managers considered Smith a troublemaking attention seeker and instructed staff to ignore her. The horrors of Canada are well hidden, Coralie Smith told The Star. What's going on behind closed doors with the Correctional Service of Canada is horrible. After her daughter's death, Smith began volunteering at women's prisons and helps implement a monthly reading program on behalf of the local Elizabeth Fry Society at Nova Institution in Truro, Nova Scotia, which is the last place she saw her daughter. I thought in a democratic society everything was open to everybody, but it's not, Smith said. I don't know what to call it. It's ludicrous. And you know something? It's not just about Ashley, she added. There are hundreds of people who have gone through the same scenarios. There are people still living in the same conditions of incarceration. I know stuff is still going on. Nothing has really changed. There is too much about the death of Ashley Smith that is in the dark, Falconer told The Star, explaining the family's motivation behind the motion. By virtue of the unplugged criminal proceedings, the absence of any commission of inquiry, and the stonewalling by the Minister of Public Safety, he said, there are too many unanswered questions. Toronto Star, Monday, August 30th, Mother MPP clash over how to help autistic boy. Madhavi Acharya Tom Yu, staff reporter. Teen's mother wants apology, but Sabara says focus of meeting was on her safety. Susan Fenty Pierce is not just the co-founder of Ontario Autism Coalition, a group that has been pushing for shorter wait times and better treatment options for autistic children. She's the mother of four boys, two with autism. Her youngest, 14-year-old Keith, is nonverbal and has become increasingly violent recently, pinching, biting, kicking, pulling her hair out, and injuring himself. Fenty Pierce's desperate search for help took her to the office of her MPP, Greg Sabara, but she says the only advice she received was insulting and insensitive. She claims Sabara suggested she should have her son charged with assault so a judge could order better treatment for him, or she could assign custody of Keith over to the Children's Aid Society. But Sabara, a foster parent to an autistic child, says his comments were misinterpreted. The only way you can get immediate access to a residential facility is for a judge to order it. That could be a criminal court judge or it could be a family court judge through Children's Aid. But I can't make an order, Sabara told the Star. He said he told her only a judge or the CAS could order treatment. At no time did I recommend it. I said that is the only way you can get access to somebody who has the authority to order it. Fenty Pierce, a registered nurse, is demanding an apology from Sabara. For an educated leader of the province to suggest that a defenseless, nonverbal child be put into the criminal system, it just dumbfounded me, Fenty Pierce told the Star from her home in Maple. He's not a criminal. He has a disability. Fenty Pierce and her husband, Ken, were joined by OAC co-founder Lori Kirby McIntosh at Sabara's constituency office. I was deeply offended, not to mention shocked, Kirby McIntosh said, referring to Sabara's comments during the hour-long meeting in a press release issued by the group Sunday. OAC's Facebook group called Tell Greg Sabara His Suggestion for Aggressive Autistic Teen is Offensive had about 245 members as of Sunday afternoon. The group wants Sabara to apologize for his remarks. Sabara says he doesn't think he has any reason to do so. I don't think Susan Fenty Pierce was really looking for assistance. I think they were looking for an opportunity to make a statement, he said. Personally, I would be much prouder of our province if we had facilities where young men or women in these circumstances could receive 24-hour care. We have some, but not enough. There are limitations on resources, Sabara said. What Fenty Pierce and other parents need is a secure facility for children and teens in the throes of violent episodes, Kirby McIntosh said. The suggestion that a jail cell is a good alternative is offensive. And in a little bit of good news for regular listeners to the show, Kaylee's father acquitted, Liam Casey, staff reporter. A man who represents himself may have a fool for a client, but Jason Wallace is no fool. Baby Kaylee's controversial father successfully defended himself on charges of uttering death threats and threatening to burn down a woman's house. Even the judge, who stopped Wallace numerous times for protocol issues, praised his performance. Mr. Wallace, the trial you conducted was commendable, said Justice Neil Kozloff. Wallace's baby daughter captured media attention in 2009 for her battle against Joubert syndrome, an often fatal brain disorder. Last year, The Sun reported on two women who started a trust fund to help pay for Kaylee's medical costs. They said Wallace wanted to use the money for a vehicle. The story drew more than 600 comments, many negative. Court heard Wallace suspected one commenter, C.D., was Cody Diaz, an acquaintance of Wallace's wife. Diaz's mother, Loretta Wilson, answered the phone when Wallace called last September to speak with her son. An argument riddled with expletives ensued, with each side accusing the other of making death threats. Wilson said Wallace threatened to burn down her house. But Crown Attorney Patrick Clement was caught off guard by one of Wallace's witnesses, Constable Tony Aiello. The officer testified about Wallace's statement regarding Wilson's alleged threat. Clement realized the Crown's evidence was faulty. I think Mr. Wallace has missed his calling, he said, offering to withdraw the charges. Wallace refused. He then submitted video of police statements made by DS and his father, Jim, noting inconsistencies between the two. Wallace called his wife, Crystal Vitelli, to the stand. "I'm going to take your memory back to last September," he said, in an effort to set the scene prior to the argument. The judge let Wallace continue, then cut him off to question Vitelli directly. "Did you hear Wallace threaten to kill Wilson?" he asked. "No," Vitelli said. After the verdict, Wallace pondered his future. "Maybe I'll run for parliament, federal or provincial. Or maybe I'll go to law school." And that's all the news there is this week. Come back next week. You know, there will be more. I don't have an artist for this. We'll have to have one for SOCAN, and we'll have to post one at radioforall.net. But I can tell you, it's pretty clear it's called The Chicken Shack.
I'm looking for that place they call the Chicken Shack. They say it's fine as wine and it's really on a ball. No windows, no doors, it's just a hole in the wall. Located down by the creek, where you can get a whole gob of good things to eat. All good parts of the chicken once more is a cinch. You can even get the last part that went over the fence. Yes, they say it's the place where all the bad cats meet. You better be mighty careful where you take a seat. Better be mighty careful, let's have a ball. Come on all you fellas and take a drink from my pack, 'cause the party's ready to start down at the Chicken Shack.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.